They crested out on the bluff in the late afternoon sun, with their shadows long on the sawgrass and burnt sedge, moving single file and slowly high above the river, and with something of its own implacability, pausing and grouping for a moment, and going on again strung out in silhouette against the sun, and then dropping under the crest of the hill into a fold of blue shadow, with light touching them about the head in spurious sanctity, until they had gone on for such a time as saw the sun down altogether, and they moved in shadow altogether, which suited them very well. When they reached the river, it was full dark, and they made camp and a small fire, across which their shapes moved in a nameless black ballet. They cooked whatever it was they had with them in whatever crude vessels and turned in to sleep, sprawled on the packed mud, full-clothed, with their mouths gaped to the stars. They were about with the first light, the bearded one rising and kicking out the other two, and still with no word among them rekindling the fire and setting their battered pannikins about it, squatting on their haunches, eating again wordlessly with belt knives, until the bearded one rose and stood spraddle-legged before the fire and closed the other two in a foul white plume of smoke, out of and through which they fought suddenly and unannounced and mute, and as suddenly ceased, picking up their ragged duffel and moving west along the river once again. She shook him awake into the quiet darkness. "Hush," she said. "Quit hollering." He sat up.
"What?"
he said.
"What?"
She shook him awake from dark to dark, delivered out of the clamorous rabble under a black sun and into a night more dolorous, sitting upright and cursing beneath his breath in the bed he shared with her and the nameless weight in her belly. Awake from this dream. There was a prophet standing in the square with arms upheld in exhortation to the beggared multitude gathered there, a delegation of human ruin who attended him with blind eyes upturned and puckered stumps and leprous sores. The sun hung on the cusp of eclipse, and the prophet spoke to them. This hour the sun would darken, and all these souls would be cured of their afflictions before it appeared again. And the dreamer himself was caught up among the supplicants, and when they had been blessed and the sun begun to blacken, he did push forward and hold up his hand and call out, "Me," he cried, "can I be cured?" The prophet looked down as if surprised to see him there amidst such pariahs. The sun paused. He said, "Yes, I think perhaps you will be cured." Then the sun buckled and dark fell like a shout. The last wire-thin rim was crept away. They waited. Nothing moved. They waited a long time, and it grew chill. Above them hung the stars of another season. There began a restlessness and a muttering. The sun did not return. It grew cold and more black and silent, and some began to cry out, and some despaired, but the sun did not return. Now the dreamer grew fearful. Voices were being raised against him. He was caught up in the crowd, and the stink of their rags filled his nostrils. They grew seething and more mutinous, and he tried to hide among them, but they knew him, even in that pit of hopeless dark, and fell upon him with howls of outrage. In the morning he heard the tinker's shoddy carillon long through the woods, and he rose and stumbled to the door to see what new evil this might be. There had been no one to the cabin for some 3 months, he himself coming harried and manic into the glade to wave away whoever by chance or obscure purpose should visit so remote a place, he himself slogging through the new spring mud 4 miles to the store and back once a week for such few things as they needed, cornmeal and coal oil and candy for her. When the tinker came rattling his cart in drunken chivalry through the clearing, he was there with wild arms like one fending back a curse. The tinker looked up, a small gnomic creature, wreathed in a morass of grizzled hair, watching him with bland gray eyes.
"Sickness here," he called. "Got sickness."
The tinker took a few last short steps, backing into the wagon's momentum like a balky mule, halted and lowered the shafts to the ground, and passed one ragged blue coat sleeve across his brow.
"What kind?" he said.
The man walked toward him, still waving one hand, his pegged brogans noiseless in the thatch of pine needles, and the only sound in the clearing the tinker's pails, penduluming with a tin clatter to gradual rest.
"Old fevery chill of some kind," the man said. "Best not to come round."
The tinker cocked his head.
"You sure it ain't the pox?" "No, done had the doctor. Said not to allow nobody around." "What is it, one of the young'uns?" "No, my sister. Ain't nobody here excepting me and her." Well, I hope her well, anyways. You all need anything? Got everything for the house, from thread to skillets. Got some awful good knives. Got DuPont's powder and most ready loads. Got coffee and tea for when the preacher comes. Got... The tinker lowered his voice and looked about him cunningly. Got the best corn whiskey you ever put in your throat. One jar left, he cautioned with upraised finger. I ain't got no money, the man said. Well, the tinker said, musing. Listen, I like to help a feller out when I can. You got everything about the place you been looking to trade off? We might could work up a trade some way. Something new and pretty might just set your sister up to where she'd feel better. I got some right pretty bonnets. Nah, the man said, towing the dust. They ain't nothing I need. I thank ye all the same. Nothing for the lady? Nah, she's mending tolerable, thank you.
The tinker looked past him at the ruined shack. He listened to the silence in which they stood.
Looky here, he said. What is it?
The man said. He motioned with crooked forefinger.
I'll just show you, he said. Here.
What is it?
The tinker reached down among his traps, groping in a greasy duck sack. He brought forth a small pamphlet and handed it slyly to the man. The man stared at it, thumbed it open, riffled the crudely printed butcher paper.
Can you cipher?
No, not good.
Don't matter no way, the tinker said. It's got pictures. Here.
He reached the book from the man and, taking a confiding stance at his side, flipped the book open to a sorry drawing of a grotesquely coital couple.
What about that? Said the tinker.
The man pushed the book at him.
Nah, he said. I don't want nothing. You excuse me. I got to see to my sister.
Well, sure now, the tinker said. I just thought I'd let you take a peek. Don't hurt nothing, do it?
Nah, I got to get on. Maybe next time you come through, I'll need something.
He was backing away, the tinker still standing with the little book in his hand, and the cupidity in his face gone to a small anger.
All right, didn't mean nothing by it. I hope you'n's well, and your sister.
Thank you, said the man.
He turned and half-lifted one arm in tentative farewell, then thrust both hands into his overalls and strode toward the cabin.
I'll be close by a few days yet,
the tinker called out after him. The man went on. The tinker spat and stepped again between the prone tongues and hoisted the cart and turned it, creaking and jangling, and set off again into the woods the way he had come. The man had stopped short of the door and stood with one foot propped on the sill, watching him out of sight. For a while he could hear the rattle and clang of the cart as it labored over the pocked and rutted road, fading, then ceasing into the faint clash of the pines and the drone of insects, and then he went in.
Culla, she said.
Yes.
That peddler have Eric Coco?
No.
I sure would admire to have me a cup of cocoa.
She sat huddled in a ragged quilt, her feet gripping the bottom rung of the chair, watching the barren fireplace in which the noon light lay among the ashes, and in which her voice trembled and returned about her.
He's done left, the man said. He ain't got nothing.
She stirred slightly.
You reckon we could have us a fire tonight?
It ain't cold.
It turned cold last night. You said your own self it was cold. I sure do admire a good fire of the evening. You reckon if it was to turn off kindly cool, we could have us a fire?
He was leaning against the door frame and slicing thin coils of wood away with his pocket knife.
Maybe, he said.
Not listening. Never listening. 3 days after the tinker's visit, she had a spasm in her belly. She said, I got a pain.
Is it it?
He said, standing suddenly from the bed where he had sat, staring out through the one small glass at the unbroken pine forest.
I don't know, she said. I reckon.
He swore softly to himself.
You going to fetch her?
He looked at her and looked away again. No, he said. She sat forward in the chair, watching across the room with eyes immense in her thin face. You said you'd fetch her when it come time.
I never, he said. I said maybe.
Fetch her, she said. Now you fetch her.
I can't. She'd tell.
Who is they to tell?
Anybody.
You could give her a dollar. Couldn't you give her a dollar not to tell and she'd not tell?
No. Asides, she ain't nothing but a old Geechee nigger witch no way.
She's been a midnight woman, caught them babies lots of times. You said your own self she was a midnight woman used to catch them babies.
She said it. I never.
He could hear her crying, a low bubbling sound, her rocking back and forth. After a while, she said, I got another'n. Ain't you going to fetch her?
No.
It had begun to rain again. The sun went bleak and pallid toward the woods. He walked into the clearing and looked up at the colorless sky. He looked as if he might be going to say something. After a while, he licked the beaded water from his lip and went in again. Dark came, and this time he did have a fire, going out from time to time with a worn axe and splitting kindling and later by lantern light, scouring the near woods for old stumps, which he split out and dressed of their rotted hearts, bringing in the hard and weathered shells and stacking them on the floor beside the hearth. She was propped in the bed now with the frayed and musty quilt still about her. Periodically she would seize the thin iron headrail behind her, coming tautly bowed and slowly up, with her breath loud in the room, and then subsiding back among the covers like a wounded bird. He had stopped asking her about it. He just waited, sitting in the chair and nursing the fire. I wish they'd hush, she said.
What?
Them varmints. He drew the poker from the fire where he had been absently stirring the coals. Somewhere between the wind's cry and the long rip of rain on the tar paper roof, he heard a dog howl.
They ain't bothering you, he said.
He heard her fingers clatter at the iron and her body rattle the springs as it arched. In a few minutes, she said, Well, I wished they'd hush. She wouldn't eat. He set a pan of cornbread on a brick before the fire and warmed it, and ate with it the last of the cold meat he had brought from the store. He took the axe from under the bed and set forth one more time for wood. It was still raining, but the wind had died, and he could hear the dull lowing of an alligator somewhere on the river. When he came in again, he stood the axe in the corner and stacked the wood and squatted once again before the fire. He was there for some time before she said his name.
What? He said.
Could you put it under the bed again? I believe it does ease it some, and it's for luck. And toward morning she called him again.
Yes, he said.
What is it? Here.
I don't hear nothing.
Here, over here. He went to her. She put his hand on the crude tick.
Your water's broke, he said.
The rain had stopped and a gray light lapped at the window glass. There was no sound but the small patter of water drops on the roof, no movement but the slow wash of mist over the glade, beyond which the trees rose blackly.
It's done morning, he said.
I've not slept nary wink. He was holding watch at the window, his own face drawn and sleepless.
I believe it wants to clear, he said.
I wonder if they's airy fire in under them ashes. He returned to the hearth and poked among the dead coals and blew upon them.
I doubt they'd be a dry stick of wood in the world this morning, he said.
The sun rose and climbed to a small, hot midpoint in the sky. In the yard, the man's shadow pooled at his feet, a dark stain in which he stood, in which he moved. In his hand, a chipped enamel water bucket now, headed for the spring, entering the woods where a path went, and following it through knee-high ferns, by rotting footlogs across a pale green fen, and into a pine wood, scrub hardwoods, the ground soft with compost and lichens, coming finally to a cairn of moss-grown rock, beneath which water issued, limpid and cold, over its bed of sun-colored sand. He bent with a pail, watched with blood-rimmed eyes a leopard frog scuttle. Coming into the clearing again, he heard her call out. He crossed the glade rapidly toward the cabin, the water licking over the bucket rim and wetting the leg of his overalls. "All right," he said, "all right." But that still wasn't it.
"It hurts bad now," she said.
"Then let's get on with it." But it wasn't until mid-afternoon that she began. He stood before the bed in which she lay bow-sprung and panting, and her eyes mad, and his hands felt huge.
"Hush," he said. "Can't you fetch her?"
"No. Hush." The spasms in which she writhed put him more in mind of death. But it wasn't death with which she labored far into the fading day. Late in the afternoon, he rose and left her and walked in the glade. Doves were crossing toward the river. He could hear them calling. When he went in again, she had crawled or fallen from the bed and lay in the floor clutching the bedstead. He did think she had died, lying there looking up with eyes that held nothing at all. Then her body convulsed and she screamed. He struggled with her, lifting her to the bed again. The head had broken through in a pumping welter of blood. He knelt in the bed with one knee, holding her. With his own hand, he brought it free, the scrawny body trailing the cord and analoid writhing down the blood-slimed covers. A beet-colored creature that looked to him like a skinned squirrel. He pinched the mucus from its face with his fingers. It didn't move. He leaned down to her.
"Rinthy?"
She turned her head. Far look and slow flutter of her pale lashes. "I'm done, ain't I?" she said. "Ain't I done?"
"Yes." "Say, Lord," she said.
When he picked it up, it squalled. He took up the cord like a hank of strange yarn and severed it with a handleless clasp knife he carried and tied it off at both ends. A deep gloom had settled in the cabin. His arms were stained with gore to the elbows. He fetched down some towels of wash-softened sacking and wet one in the water bucket. He wiped the child and wrapped it in a dry towel. It had not stopped wailing.
"What is it?" she said.
"What?"
"It. What is it?"
"A chap." "Well," she said,
"it's puny."
"Don't sound puny."
"I don't look for it to live."
"It sounds peart enough."
"You best sleep some."
"I wished I could," she said. "I ain't never been no tireder." He rose and went to the door, standing for a moment in the long quadrangular light of evening, his elbow against the jamb and his head resting on his forearm. He opened his hand and looked at it. Dried blood sifted in a fine dust from the lines of his palm. After a while, he went in and poured water into the tin basin and began to wash his hands and his arms, slowly and with care. When he came past the bed wiping his face with a towel, she was asleep. The child slept, too, his old man's face flushed and wrinkled, small fingers clenched. Reaching down and refolding the towel about it, he took it up in his arms and, looking once again at the woman, crossed to the door and outside. The sand of the road was scored and banded with shadow, dark beneath the pine and cedar trees, or fiddle-backed with a slender shade of cane. Shadows which kept compass against all the road's turnings. He stopped from time to time, holding the child gingerly, listening. When he reached the bridge, he turned off the road and took a path along the river, the swollen waters coming in a blood-colored spume from about the wooden stanchions and fanning in the pool below with a constant and vicious hissing. He followed it down, carrying the child before him delicately, hurrying at a half-jog and keeping one eye skyward as if to measure against his progress the sun's, the deepening shade. Half a mile downriver, he came to a creek, a stream of amber swamp water that the river sucked from high grass banks into a brief, immiscible stain of dark clarity. Here he left the river and took a new course into the wood. The country was low and swampy, sawgrass and tule, tufted hummocks among the scrub trees. He veered from the creek to gain drier ground, half running now, breaking through a patch of alder upon a small pothole, out of which a heron exploded slowly and rose before him with immense and labored wingbeat. Before dark, he came upon the creek again, smaller and clear, choked with duckwort and watercress, the flat, verdant ground stretching away everywhere beneath the sparse cover of trees, and a coppery haze quivering like some rare dust in this twilight. The child had come awake again and begun to squall. He entered a stand of cottonwoods, where the ground held moss of a fiery nitric green, and which he prodded with his foot for a moment, and then laid the child upon. It howled red-gummed at the pending night. He stood back from it and watched it dumbly. It kicked away the towel and lay naked with legs pedaling. He knelt forward in the damp earth and covered it again, and then rose to his feet and lumbered away through the brush without looking back. He did not return along the creek, but took his bearings by what faint light still lay in the west and struck out across country. The air was dank and stormy. Night fell long and cool through the woods about him, and a spectral quietude set in, as if something were about that crickets and nightbirds held in dread. He went on faster. With full dark, he was confused in a swampy forest, floundering through sucking quagmires and half-running. He did not come upon the river, but upon the creek again, or another creek. He followed it down, in full flight now, the trees beginning to close him in, malign and baleful shapes that reared like enormous androids, provoked at the alien insubstantiality of this flesh, colliding among them. Long and long after he should have reached the river, he was careering through the woods with his hands outstretched before him against whatever the dark might hold, until he began to stumble and a cold claw was raking upward through his chest. When he came upon the creek again, he splashed into it, thigh and crotch, before he knew it was there. He stopped, his breath roaring, trying to listen. Very far away, lightning quaked once, again, soundlessly. The current moved dimly about him. He spat. His saliva bloomed palely on the water and wheeled and slid inexplicably upstream, back the way he had come. He turned and watched it in disbelief. He plunged his arm into the water. It seemed motionless. He spat again and again. The spittle flared and trembled and listed perverse. He surged from the water and began to run in the return direction and at a demented pace through the brush and swamp growth, falling, rising, going on again. When he crashed into the glade among the cottonwoods, he fell headlong and lay there with his cheek to the earth. And as he lay there, a far crack of lightning went bluely down the sky and bequeathed him in an embryonic bird's first fissured vision of the world and transpiring instant and outrageous from dark to dark, a final view of the grotto and the shapeless white plasm struggling upon the rich and incunabular moss like a lank swamp hare. He would have taken it for some boneless cognate of his heart's dread had the child not cried. It howled execration upon the dim Camerine world of its nativity, wail on wail while he lay there gibbering with palsied jaw hasps, his hands putting back the night like some witless paraclete beleaguered with all limbo's clamor. It was early morning when the tinker appeared upon the bridge, coming from the woods with a sprightly hop, like a stage dwarf after the main company has departed. He peered both up and down the road. Satisfied, he left the bridge and took the path along the river, going bow-backed among the rushes with his curious, mage-like agility. The sun was well up, and the bracken along the shore steamed in the rising warmth. The tinker hummed a little air to himself as he went. When he came to the branch where it joined the river, he cast about for a crossing, coming finally to a narrows a short distance upstream. When he came back into the river path on the far side, the tracks he followed had ceased.
"Whoa now," he said. "Which way we a-going here?"
He recrossed the creek and picked up the man's trace in a furrow of crushed ferns that led into the woods.
"Ah," he said, "we a-taken to the deep pineys."
He lost the tracks more than once going up the branch, but he paid that no mind. He was watching for tracks coming from the other way, and he could find none. After he had gone a mile or so, he ran out of any kind of track at all. He circled and returned, finding nothing. Finally, he crossed the branch and went down the far side, and very soon he came upon the tracks again. He followed them into a small clearing, and here they ceased. He looked about him. It appeared to be the same place in which the tracks coming up the near side had vanished, as if their maker had met in this forest some dark other self in chemistry with whom he had been fused, traceless from the earth. Then he heard the child cry. He turned, small grin among his wire whiskers. He found it at the far end of the clearing in a cup of moss, naked and crying no louder than a kitten.
"Well, well," he said, kneeling. "You a mouthy chap if ye are a poor un."
He poked a finger at it as one might a tomato or a melon.
"Little woodsy cold, ain't you? Looks like somebody meant for you to stay in the woods."
He folded the towel about it and picked it up, and holding it against the bib of his overalls with one arm, began his way down the creek again. When he reached the bridge in the road, he had not been gone 2 hours. The child blinked mindlessly at the high sun. The tinker entered the woods on the other side of the road, where he had hidden the cart, and searched among his goods until he came up with some cheap gingham in which to wrap the child. It drooped into sleep against his thin chest, its face mauve and wrinkled, as though beset already with some anguish or worry. He placed it between some sacks in the floor of the cart and regarded it.
"Well," he said, "you alive if you ain't kicking."
He stooped and took up the tongues of the cart and set off through the woods, into the road, the wending, trackless corridor down which echoed the clatter of his wagon and the endless tympanic collision of his wares. He did not stop when he reached the store. He turned left onto the state road, going north now, moving with the same tireless pace. The child had not cried, and he had not looked at it. Late in the afternoon, he stopped to eat, and it did cry, a thin and labored squall as he bent above it, his mouth slow and ruminative, chewing, dry cornbread collecting in his beard and sifting down upon the child.
"Tell him about it," he said.
When the sun had gone, he went on in darkness, the child quiet again, as if motion were specific against anything that ailed it. The moon came up and grew small, and the road before him went white as salt. He jangled on through an ice-blue light in his amulet of sound. Before midnight, he entered a town, past a mill where a wheel rumbled drunkenly under its race, and water fell with a windy slash, past stores and shops, dark, clustered houses heralded and attended by the outcry of dogs down the empty streets, and on again into the patched farmland. Another mile and he came to a wagon drive and a house a short way from the road that sat likewise in darkness. He pulled up before the door and lowered the cart to the ground.
"Hello there," he called.
He waited. After a while, light appeared very faint and yellow among the weather-riven slats, and a woman's voice said,
"Who's out there?"
"Me,"
said the tinker.
"Come in,"
she said, swinging open the door and standing there in a rough shift with a tallow candle in one hand. He stamped his boots ceremonially once each on the sill and entered.
"Howdy,"
he said.
"Late hours for an old man, ain't it?"
she said.
"It's late hours for a young one. I need me a nurse woman."
"I've never questioned that."
"No, here, don't shut the door. It's for this here younger'n."
"What younger'n?"
"One I got in the cart. Bring that candle here."
She followed him out suspiciously and peered past his shoulder, down into the cart where the child lay sleeping.
"Looky here,"
he said.
"They, Lord God."
"Here, let me fetch him out."
"You take this candle," she said. "I'll fetch him out." It came awake with a thin yowl. She gathered it up and they went into the house and stretched it out on the crude board table, hovering above it nervously.
"Lord," she said, "it ain't but just born."
"I know it,"
he said.
"Where all did it come from?"
"I found it in the woods," he said. "It had been throwed away and I found it."
"This poor thing needs fed."
"I know it," he said. "Is they airy nurse about here?"
She was biting the backs of her knuckles.
"Mrs. Laird," she said. "She's just got her a new chap." "You reckon she'll take it?"
"She ain't got nary choice. Here, he needs better wrapped. Mind him a minute while I get some things and we'll go."
"Where does she live at?"
"Just up the road. You mind him a minute."
Setting forth in the faint moonlight, the tinker now at her elbow and her carrying the child, wrapped completely from sight, they appeared furtive, clandestine, stepping softly and soft their voices over the sandy road in shadows so foreshortened they seemed sprung and frenzied with a violence in which their creators moved with dreamy disconcern. It did not rain again. He looked for it too, dark and starless as it was, coming down a road he could not see and through a wood kept by nothing he could hear. When he entered the glade, a small hot moon came dishing up from the overcast to see him home. There was no light in the cabin. He stood for a moment with a rack of his chest bones rising and falling. She was sleeping. When he emerged from the cabin again, he was carrying the axe. He crossed the glade to the spring path and entered the woods. In a grove of black haws, he stopped and looked about him and then sank the axe into the earth. He passed his shirt cuff across his forehead and took up the axe again and began to hack at the ground with crazed industry. She had tried once to reach for the lamp, but she could not move. She called his name softly in the quiet, but there was no answer. The door was open, and after a while he was standing in it, he and the axe in an assassin silhouette against the slack gloss of the moon. He crossed to the table and took up the lamp and lit it, shaping the room from darkness. He turned to see her watching him, pale and disheveled, and with such doll's eyes of painted china. "Gulla," she said.
"You best hope it's me."
"Where you been?"
"Out."
"Where's it at?"
There was a long silence. He had not set the lamp down. He was holding the stained chimney in one hand, and she could hear him breathing in the quiet. The flame, trembling, unhoused between them, held her eyes.
"It died," he said.
When she woke in the morning, he was not there either. There was a small fire on the hearth, and she watched that. He came in after a while, bearing wood, but he did not speak. He got the dipper from the water bucket and brought it to her, helping her up with one hand, her neck craned, drinking, on her lips a white paste that clove to the dipper rim.
"I want some more," she said.
He brought it. When she had finished, she lay back and watched the fire again.
"How you feel this morning?" he said.
"I don't know. I don't feel much of nothing."
"You'll be ailing some for a spell, I would reckon."
"I feel fevery."
"You hungry?"
"I ain't real hungry."
"You want eggs?" "I believe there's egg."
"If we got Harry," she said.
There was one egg. He spooned lard into a pan and fried it over the fire and brought it to her along with a chunk of cornbread.
"I got to go to the store today," he said.
"I got to go somewheres myself, but I ain't able."
She was eating very slowly, her eyes on the plate.
"Yes," he said. "All right, I'll get something."
And she was bleeding again. He wet a fresh cloth and gave it to her.
"You want anything?"
he said.
"No, I don't want nothing."
He took down a knotted handkerchief from the sideboard and untied it, laying the cloth out and unfolding a small sheaf of paper dollars. He counted them and took one, together with what loose coins there were, and put these in the pocket of his overalls. Then he retied the kerchief with the remaining money and put it back in the cupboard.
"I'm gone," he said.
"All right."
He stopped at the door and looked at her. She turned her head away slowly. It was mid-morning when he set out, and it took him just a little over an hour to reach the store at the junction, the sun warm on his back and the fine pumice of the road already paling and going to dust again. A horsefly followed behind his head as if towed there on a string. When he got to the store, it was closed. He rattled the latch and peered inside. From an upper window, a voice called down, "We still Christians here. You'll have to come back a weekday." He turned away. By noon, he was at the cabin again, sitting on a stump in the glade and carving at it intently with his knife. When he went in, she was asleep in her foul bed. He sat before the fireplace, watching ashes rise and wheel feebly in the cold light that fell there. She stirred heavily in her sleep, moaning. He watched her. When he could stay no longer, he went out again and walked down the road. He could not decide what to do. He sat on a stone by the side of the road and, with a dead stick, drew outlandish symbols in the dust. They made their meal that night on the last stale pieces of cornbread, a fine mold like powdered jade beginning on them where they lay dried and curling in the cupboard. She did not even ask him about the store. After she was asleep, he again appropriated the quilt from off the bed and spread it upon the floor. He removed his shoes and lay down and folded the quilt over himself,
and stared at what shadows the joists and beams made upon the roof's underside. The lamp guttered and ceased. His eyes were closed. Before he slept, he saw again the birth-stunned face, the swamp trees in a dark bower above the pale and naked flesh, and the black blood seeping from the navel. He woke early, the hard boarding laminated against his spine. A smoky light crept on the one pane of glass. He rose and refolded the quilt, replaced it at the foot of the bed, and got his shoes and put them on, watching her, finally leaning above her wasted face to hear her breath. He took a drink of water from the bucket and opened the door on this new day, leaning in the doorframe, drinking. He shook the last of the water from the dipper and stretched, one hand to the small of his back. Before it was full daylight, he had gone to the spring again, the empty pail jiggling against his thigh, against pathside briars with a tin squeal, kneeling finally and watching the water suck cold and sandy over the bucket rim, filling and setting it on the bank, and leaving water on his wrists and forearms, dipping two palmfuls against his forehead, leaning his mouth into the meniscal calm of it, wide and tilting in the water the eyes that watched his eyes. He set the bucket on the table and took up the weightless dipper and floated it on top. She was watching him. "I'd admire to have me a drink of that there fresh spring water," she said. He brought it to her, watched her drink.
"You want more?"
he said. She held up the empty dipper. "If there is some," she said.
"There's a bucketful if you want it."
She sat with her hands clasped between her breast and her belly while he brought the dipper to her again. Light from the window lay in a niggardly stain across the bed. "If that old winder was washed," she said, "I bet you could see out every which way."
"Funny to me you never noticed it when you was up and able."
"I could get out my own self then," she said, "instead of having to lay up and look out a winder." He took the empty dipper from her and crossed the room.
"I ain't washing no winders,"
he said. "Well?"
"Well what?"
"Nothing. I just said well."
"You better just."
"I thought I heard that old tinker back this morning," she said, "messing around." He had been looking through the cupboard, and now he stopped and closed the doors and looked at her. She was staring vacantly out toward the pines.
"That old tinker," he said, "is long gone."
She looked at him. "I just wondered," she said. "I heard some kind of commotion sounded like him."
"Well, it wasn't."
She watched him. "Where are you going?" she said.
"Store."
"You reckon they got every bit more of that black candy like they had?"
"I'll see,"
he said. "All right."
"Don't take in no strangers while I'm gone."
She sighed deeply. "They ain't a soul in this world but what is a stranger to me," she said. She was keeping tally of the days. At the end of a week, she climbed from the bed and walked to the foot of it and back. The next day, she couldn't get up at all. But within the week, she was walking about the cabin painfully each time he left. One evening, when he came in, she was sitting in the chair, demurely and half-smiling, her figure thin and wasted under the ragged shift she wore, as if great age had come upon her, and her eyes huge and fever-black. He entered slowly and shut the door.
"Well,"
he said.
"You feeling that peart?"
"I'm better from what I was."
"You fell off considerable, ain't you?"
"Lord," she said, "I've gained back from what I was. I was puny as... I wasn't nothing but a shadder." He eased himself down on the bed. When he looked at her again and the light falling slantwise across her, he could see like dark tears, two milk stains in the thin cotton cloth. He looked away. His hands lay palm upward on his thighs, and he sat watching them as if they were somehow unaccountable. Within the next few days, she was walking about in the dooryard, taking the sun, as she said. He watched her poke along in her mincing shuffle, as if she carried an egg between her knees.
"Man, woman,"
he said. He was sitting cross-legged in the shade of the house, with the shotgun dismantled, and hammering at the worn sear notch with a piece of wagon spring. "You fixin' to tear up Daddy's gun?" she said.
It ain't Daddy's gun,
he said, not looking up. She watched him.
You ain't got airy shells,
she said. He held the lock plate between his knees and cocked the hammer.
Now, damn ye, slip if you can,
he said.
What?
She said.
I was talking to the gun.
Culla, she said.
What?
Nothing. But 2 days later, she stopped him as he came through the door with a chipped and yellowed pail in which he bore water, her standing almost in the doorway and arresting him with one arm. He paused to lean against the jamb and looked down at her.
Well,
he said.
What?
Culla. He went past her and put the bucket on the table. She had her hand to her mouth, watching him with huge eyes. He put the dipper in the pail and took a drink. He wiped his mouth and looked at her. Culla.
What, damn it?
I just wanted to ask where it's at. He winced and his eyes went narrow.
What do you mean?
He said. Her hands worked nervously. I just wanted to know where it was you put him.
In the ground.
Well, she said, I just thought maybe if you was to show me where at, I could see it. And maybe put some flowers or something.
Flowers,
he said.
It ain't even got a name.
She was twisting her hands again, and he came from the table where he had been leaning and started past her. Culla. He stopped at the door and looked at her. She hadn't even looked around. We could give it one, she said.
It's dead, he said. You don't name things dead.
She turned slowly. It wouldn't hurt nothing, she said.
Damn you,
he said.
The flowers, if you want. I'll show you.
He crossed the clearing in the windy sunlight, unmindful of her hobbling behind him, stopping at the edge of the woods where the path went until she should catch up, not even turning to watch this child's figure that struggled toward him like a crippled marionette. He pointed out the way to her.
To the footlog, he said. Then you want to go right. They's a clearing, a clump of black haws. You'll see it.
She went happily, flushed, shuffling through the woods and plucking the shy wildflowers that sat upon the sun-patched earth and half-shrouded under old leaves, glared back a small violence of color upon the bland March skies. With her bouquet clutched in both hands before her, she stepped finally into the clearing, a swatch of grass, sunlight, bird calls, crossing with quiet and guileless rectitude to stand before a patch of black and cloven earth. Some willingness to disbelief must have made her see and reflect. Certainly it could have held a grown man, this piece of ground gutted and strewn with mulch, slug-white roots upturned to the disastrous light. She bent slowly and with pain and laid the flowers down. She knelt so for some time. And then she leaned forward and placed one palm on the cool earth. And then she began to scoop away the dirt with her hands. She had not dug but a few inches before she came upon packed clay, unsevered roots. She chose another spot and soon uncovered a bedded rock, which, bared to the oblique lightfall of the sun's retrograde, lay scored with powdery axe marks. His long shadow overrode her, but she did not see it. She stood and turned and found herself against his chest. She screamed and fell back, stumbled to the ground, crushing the flowers, the blood starting again, warm on her leg. But he was the one, kneeling in the dark earth with his writhen face howling at her, saying, "Now you done it. Now you really went and done it." And her own face, still bland and impervious, in such wonder he mistook for accusation, silent and inarguable female invective, until he rose and fled, bearing his clenched hands above him threatful, supplicant to the mute and windy heavens. They entered the lot at a slow jog, the peaceful and ruminative stock coming erect, watchful, shifting with eyes sidled as they passed, the three of them paying no heed, seeming blind with purpose, passing through an ether of smartweed and stale ammonia steaming from the sun-bleared chicken run and on through the open doors of the barn and almost instantly out the other side, marvelously armed with crude agrarian weapons, spade and brush hook, emerging in an explosion of guinea fowl and one screaming sow, unaltered in gait, demeanor, or speed,
Parodic figures transposed live and intact and violent out of a proletarian mural and set mobile upon the empty fields, advancing against the twilight, the droning bees, and wind-tilted clover. The storm had abated, but rain still fell. He sat watching it with his chin propped on the soured and thin-worn knees of his overalls, crouched on his narrow strip of dead earth, the fine clay dust, musty and airless, even above the rank breath of the wet spring woods. Night came and he slept. When he woke again, it was to such darkness he did not trust his balance. He was very cold. He curled himself up on the ground and listened to the rain drifting in a rapid patter with the wind across the forest. When morning came, he was sitting again with his knees tucked up, waiting. And with the first smoky portent of light, he rose and set forth from the shelter of the cliff and through the steaming woods to the road, now a flume of ash-colored loam through which he struggled with weighted shoes, his hands pocketed and head cupped between his shoulder blades. He reached the town before noon, mud slathered to his knees, wading through a thick mire in which the tracks of wagons crossed everywhere with channels of milky gray water. Entering the square among the midday traffic, a wagon passing him in four pinwheels of flickering mud. He watched it pull up before a store, the horse coming to rest in an ooze that reached its fetlocks, and the high wheels of the wagon sucking halfway to their hubs. He reached the store as the driver was turning and getting down.
"Howdy," he said.
"I do," said the driver, pulling a sack from the wagon bed.
"A mite boggy, ain't she?"
"Yes, 'tis," he said.
"You need any help?"
"Thank you," said the man.
"I can get it all right."
He levered the sack onto his shoulder, nodded to Holm, standing there holding the door, and went in, disappearing to the rear of the building. Holm approached the counter, unknotting the kerchief and removing two coins.
"Yes?"
the clerk said, looking up out of the shabby and ludicrous propriety of his celluloid collar and wine-colored cravat, his slight figure lost in a huge green coat, coarse-woven and yieldless as iron.
"Dime's worth of cheese and crackers," Holmes said.
"A dime's worth each?"
"No, both." "A nickel's worth each, then,"
the clerk said. Holmes was looking about him at the varieties of merchandise. He looked at the clerk.
"What?"
he said.
"I said a nickel's worth each."
"That'd be a side of crackers, wouldn't it?"
"I don't know."
Holmes seemed to be thinking about something else. After a minute, he drummed his knuckles on the counter and looked up.
"You ever eat cheese and crackers?"
he said.
"Yes,"
said the clerk with dignity.
"Well, I'd like a dime's worth like a person would eat."
The clerk adjusted the shoulders of his weighty coat with a shrug and went down the counter to where a wooden box stood and from which he began to ladle crackers into a paper. Then he went on, stooping below the counter. Holm wasn't watching. His gray eyes moved over the tiered wares with vague wonder. The clerk returned and laid the cheese and crackers before him, each wrapped in a paper, and looked up at him.
"What else now?"
he said.
"Take out for dope,"
Holmes said, nudging the coins across the trade-worn wood.
"To drink here?"
"Just outside."
"You'd like two pennies,"
the clerk said with a small, malignant smile.
"For what?"
"The bottle.
I ain't going but just to the front stoop with it."
"Well, he don't like for me to let him leave the store." Holm looked at him.
"Of course, if you ain't got it, you could drink it in here."
"Shit," Holm said. The clerk flushed. Holm reached again into the pocket of his overalls and plucked forth the kerchief. He took out the two bits of copper with a disdainful flourish and let them trickle down over the counter.
"Thank ye,"
said the clerk, raking the coins into his palm. He rattled them into the wooden cash drawer and looked up at Holm with satisfaction. Holm grunted, gathered up the two packets, crossed the floor to the cool box and got the drink and went out. While he was sitting on the stone veranda eating the cheese and crackers in the noon sun, the wagon driver reappeared from the store and took a practiced leap up onto the box, unlooped the reins from the whip stand, and cocked one mud-cumbered boot upon the dashboard.
"Say,"
Holm said. The driver paused in the act of chucking the reins and looked down.
"Yes,"
he said.
"Say, you don't need no help."
"Nope, don't believe I do."
"Well, you don't know where a man might find work hereabouts, do you?"
The driver studied him.
him looking up with eyes narrowed against the light, his jaws working slowly over the dry crackers.
Steady work? Any kind.
Well, the driver said, the mill ought to be taking on summer hands in a week or so. He looked down at the man again, but the man said nothing, watching him, chewing.
Yes, he said. Listen, maybe the squire might have something, some work around the house or something.
He seized up the reins again.
Where's he at?
The man took the reins in one hand, and with the other he pointed down the road to the north.
About a quarter mile, he said. Big house on the left as you leave town. You'll see it.
He lifted the reins and chucked them, and the horse leaned into the traces and broke the wheels with a slight sucking noise.
Much obliged, Holmes said.
The man raised one hand. He watched them go, the bottle tilted upward to his mouth, watching the horse veer and wobble, the wheels dripping back into their furrows, the upturned clots of muck. He took the empty bottle inside and collected his money and came out again and started down the road the way the man had directed him. He did see it, a large two-story house fronted with wooden columns on which the paint lay open in long fence like slashed paper, and a yellow stain of road dust paling upward in the sunlight until the gables shone clean and white. He turned up the graveled drive and walked around the house along a little cobbled walkway until he came to what he took for the back door. He tapped and waited. No one came. He tapped again. After a while, he went on to the other side of the house. There was a kitchen door and a window through which he could see an old Negro woman bending over a table and paring potatoes. He tapped at the glass. She came to the door and opened it and looked at him.
Is the squire in?
He said. Just a minute, she said, pushing the door half to, but not closing it. He could hear her shuffling away, and then he could hear her calling. He waited. Presently, he heard footsteps crossing the floor, and then the door opened again, and a big man looked out at him with hard black eyes and said,
Yes?
Howdy, he said. I was talking to a man down to the store, said you might need some help, said you might have some work.
No,
the squire said.
Well,
he said, I thank you. He turned and started away.
You,
the squire said. He stopped and looked back.
You don't mind no for an answer, do you?
I figured you would know one way or the other, he said.
Or maybe you don't need work all that bad. I asked for it. I ain't scared to. Come here a minute.
He retraced his steps and stood facing the squire again, the squire looking him over with those hard little eyes as he would anything for sale.
You got a good arm,
he said.
Can you swing an axe?
I've been known to, he said. The squire seemed to weigh something in his mind.
Tell you what I'll do with you,
he said.
You want to earn your supper, there's a tree blowed down out back here, needs cut up to stove wood.
All right.
All right, huh? Wait here a minute.
He went away in the house, and then in a few minutes he was back, and led the man outside, motioning him with one finger across the yard toward a workshed. They entered, and he could see in the gloom a Negro bent over a piece of machinery.
John,
the squire said. The Negro rose wordlessly and approached them.
Give this man an axe,
he said. He turned to Holm.
Can you sharp it?
Yes, sir,
he said.
And turn the wheel for him to sharp it.
The Negro nodded.
Right, said the squire. Every man to grind his own axe. All right, it's in the side over yonder. You'll see it. Just a little old pine. What's your name?
Holm.
You ain't got but one name?
Culler Holm.
What?
Culler.
All right, Holm. I like to know a man's name when I hire him. I like to know that first. The rest I can figure for myself. John here will fix you up. 2-foot chunks and holler when you get done.
He went out and Holm was left facing the Negro. The Negro had yet to speak. He went past with a great display of effort, one hand to his kidney, shuffling. He fumbled in a corner of the shed for some time and came forth with the axe from the clutter of tools in a broken barrel. The man watched him take it up with endless patience out of a shapeless bloom of staves, skewed all awry as if this container had been uncoopered violently in some old explosion, take it up and hand it to him without comment, and shuffle on to the stone which he now began to crank. Holm watched him. The wheel trundled woodenly, He laid the rusted bit against it and pressed out a sheaf of sparks, which furled in a bright orbit there and raced and faded across the Negro's glistening face, a mute black skull immune to fire. The eyes closed. A dark wood carving provoked again and again out of the gloom until the steel was properly sharp.
"That's good," he said.
The Negro opened his eyes, rose and nodded, and returned to the bench where he had been working. He went out, hefting the weight of the axe in his hand, and by the better light at the door of the shed, examining the edge of it. The tree was not far from the house. It was broken off some 6 feet from the ground, and the standing trunk, with its hackle of ribboned wood, looked like it had been chewed off by some mammoth browsing creature. He paced off the fallen section and, straddling the trunk, working backwards, dressed off the limbs. Then he marked off 2 feet from the butt end and sank the axe into the wood. He worked easily, letting the weight of the axe head carry the bite. He had cut 4 sections before he stopped to rest. He looked at what he was doing, and then he looked at the sun. He stood the axe against the stump and returned to the shed to look for the Negro, but he wasn't there. He crossed the yard to the kitchen door again and knocked. When she opened it, he could smell cooking.
"I wonder, could I see the squire a minute?" he said.
The squire came to the door and peered out at him as if dim of recollection.
"What?" he said. "A thaw? I thought you was done." "No, sir, not yet. I thought maybe it might go a little quicker with a saw."
The squire watched him as if awaiting some further explanation. Holm looked down at his feet. Across the door sill in the rich aura of cookery, the squire's figure reared silently out of a pair of new veal boots.
"Just a little old buck saw or something," Holm said.
"They ain't no saw," the squire said. "It's broke."
"Well,
I thought you hired out as an axe hand."
Holm looked up at him.
"Wasn't that what you hired out for?"
"Yes, sir," Holm said.
"I reckon."
He looked at the squire to see if he might be smiling, but the squire wasn't smiling.
"Was there anything else you wanted?"
"No, sir, I reckon not."
"Well?"
"Well," Holm said, "I'll get on back to it."
The squire said nothing. Holm turned and started back across the yard. As he passed through the gate, he looked back. The squire had not moved. He stood rigid and upright in the coffin-sized doorway with no expression, no hint of a smile, no list to his bearing. He worked on through the afternoon while shadow of post and tree drew lean and black across the grass. It was full evening before he was done. He stacked the last pieces and shouldered the axe and went on across the lot toward the shed. This time the Negro was there and he handed him the axe, still neither of them speaking, and went to the door of the house again and knocked for the third time this day.
"I won't even ask if you're done," the squire said.
"All right."
"All right, well, I reckon you're hungry, ain't you?"
"Some."
"I reckon you just eat twice a day. Or is it once?"
"Why?" Holm said.
"You never ate no dinner as I know of."
"I wasn't offered none."
"You never asked for none."
Holm was silent.
"You never asked for nothing."
"I just come hunting work," Holm said.
The squire hauled by its long chain a watch from somewhere in his coat, snapped it open and glanced at it, and put it away.
"It's near 6 o'clock, he said. "Like in about 3 minutes. How much time would you say you put in on that job?"
"I don't know," Holm said. "I don't know what time it was I commenced."
"Is that right? Don't know?"
"No, sir."
"Well, it was just before dinner, and now it's just before supper. That's the best part of half a day, ain't it?"
"I reckon," he said.
The squire leaned slightly forward.
"For your supper?"
he said. Holm was silent.
"So I reckon a full day would be for dinner and supper. Still ain't said nothing about breakfast, let alone a place to sleep, not even to mention money." "You was the one," Holm said. "You said what... And you was the one said, all right. Come on, man, what is it you've done? Where are you running from, huh?"
"I ain't running from nowheres."
"No? You ain't? Where are you from? I never asked you that, did I?"
"I come from down on the Chicken River."
"No," the squire said. "My wife's people was from down that way, little as I like to say it."
I just lived there this past little while. I never claimed to have been born there.
Before that, then, where did you live before?
I come from downstate.
I bet you do at that, the squire said. And then you come up here, or down in Johnson County. And now you up here. What is it, you like to travel? When did you eat last, if it's any of my business?
I ate this morning.
This morning? Out of somebody's garden, most likely.
I got money, Holmes said.
I won't ask you where you come by it. You married?
No, I ain't married.
He looked up at the squire. Their shadows canted upon the whitewashed brick of the kitchen shed in a pantomime of static violence, in which the squire reeled backward and he leaned upon him in headlong assault.
It ain't no crime to be poor, he said.
No, it ain't. It ain't a crime. I hope you've not got a family. It's a sacred thing, a family, a sacred obligation, afore God.
The squire had been looking away, and now he turned to home again.
It ain't no crime to be poor, he said. That's right. But shiftlessness is a sin, I would judge. Wouldn't you?
I reckon, he said.
Yes, the Bible reckons. What I got, I earned. There's not a man in this county will tell you different. I've never knowed nothing but hard work. I've been many a time in the field at daybreak waiting for the sun to come up to commence work, and I was there when it went down again. Daybreak to backbreak for a God-given dollar. There ain't a man in this county will dispute it.
Holmes was looking down, one hand crossed over the back of the other, the way men stand in church. There was a commotion of hens from beyond the barn, a hog squeal, ceasing again into the tranquility of bird calls and cicadas.
All right, Holmes, the squire said. I ain't going to ask you no more of your business.
He had out a small leather purse now, which he unsnapped, and lightened by the weight of a half dollar.
Here, he said, and your supper. Supper's at 6:30, in the kitchen. You can wash up now if you've a mind to.
He took the coin, holding it in his hand as if he had no place to put it.
All right, he said.
After he had washed, he sat in the shade of the tool shed and pared idly at the sole of his shoe with the knife he carried. He watched the negro cross from the barn to the house. In a few minutes, he came from the kitchen door and returned across the yard again, a small figure scuttling from shadow to shadow with laborious ill grace, carrying in one hand the squire's boots, and disappearing into the barn. The squire was an early riser, and it was not yet good light when he went to the barn.
"You, home!"
he called up the chaff-dusted ladder and into the dark hatchway of the loft. No one answered. The negro was coming through the far end of the barn carrying a bucket.
"Where's he at?" the squire said. "Is he gone?"
The negro nodded his head.
"He sure is an early bird. When did he skedaddle?"
The negro slid the bucket up onto his wrist and made a motion with his hands.
"Well,"
the squire said. He looked about him uncertainly, like a man who has forgotten something. Then he said,
"Where's them boots?"
The negro had started toward the corn crib, and now he stopped and looked around, his face already shining with grease or sweat, whatever it was, like wet obsidian. He did not even motion with his hands. They stood looking at each other for just a minute, and then the squire said,
"God damn. I will be purely God damned. That ingrate son of a bitch. You never should have left. Hitch up for me while I get the shotgun."
Turning and wheeling out of the barn, the negro following him with that same poverty of motion and taking up harness gear from where it hung on the wall as he went. In a few minutes, the squire was back with a shotgun and a white hat jammed onto his head, leaping up into the wagon and sitting there in furious immobility, and then leaping down again to fumble with the harness while the negro led the horse forth from the stall, not telling him to hurry or anything so useless, and finally waiting in a throb of violent constraint while the negro backed the horse between the wagon shafts and while he hitched it, and until he stepped back, and then raising up the reins and slapping them across the horse's rump, lifting two ribbons of rank dust out of its hide and starting, and then suddenly drawing up again and leaning down.
"Town? You think he might have gone back through?"
"No."
"All right, I'll..."
The mute negro laboring in the air with his dark and bony fingers and the squire.
"The what?"
The brush hook? What else? Damn! God damn!
And exploding out of the lot with the horse rearing under the reins and the wagon skewing about and then down the drive onto the road at a mad clatter and gone. The Negro returned to the barn and took up the pail from where he had left it, going past the stalls to the corn crib, where he seated himself on a milking stool and began to shell corn, his hard hand twisting the kernels loose and them sifting bright and hard down into the pail, ringing like coins. The squire at mid-morning was following a log road, urging the horse on, and the horse already faded to a walk when they came out of the brush behind him. He turned when he heard them, and he turned back. They were coming along the road. One of them said something, and then one of them said Harmon, and then one of them was alongside, seizing the horse's reins. The squire stood in the wagon.
"Here," he said. "What do you think you're doing? Here now, by God!"
Reaching and taking up the shotgun where it stood, leaning against the seat. They came across the field attended by a constant circus of grasshoppers catapulting from the sedge and entered the wood deployed in the same ragged phalanx, while before them passed solitary over no visible road a horse and a wagon surmounted by a harried-looking man in a white hat. They altered their course and came upon a log road down which the wagon receded in two thin tracks and upon a burst lizard who dragged his small blue bowels through the dirt, breaking into a trot. A run, the first of them reaching the horse and seizing the reins and turning up to the driver a mindless smile, clutching the horse's withers and clinging there like some small and vicious anthroparian, and the driver rising in remonstration from the wagon box so that when the next one came up behind him sideways in a sort of dance and swung the brush hook, it missed his neck and took him in the small of the back, severing his spine, and when he fell unhinged sideways and without a cry. She did not know that he had taken the gun. She did not know that the money was gone, and she had never known how much there was of it. She went about the house gathering her things, laying out her dress on the bed and examining it before she stripped out of the shift and put it on. She pirouetted slowly in the center of the room like a doll unwinding for just a moment, and then took off the dress and scrubbed herself with a rag and cold water as best she could, and with a piece of broken comb raked her dead yellow hair. She set out her shoes and dusted them and put them on and the dress. Of the shift, she made a package in which lay rolled her small and derelict possessions. And thus equipped, she took a final look about to see what had been forgotten. There was nothing. She tucked the package beneath her arm and set forth, short-gaited and stiffly, humming softly to herself and so into the sunshine that washed fitfully with the spring wind over the glade, turning her face up to the sky and bestowing upon it a smile all bland and burdenless as a child's. She crossed the river bridge, walking carefully on the ill-fitted planks, looking down at the water. She nudged pebbles through the cracks and watched them diminish with slow turnings into sudden printed rings upon the river that sucked away like smoke. She went on, resting from time to time quietly by the side of the road and patting the sweat from her brow with the parcel she carried. When she came at last into sight of the crossroads, she could see someone coming far down the road and misshapen with heat. She looked about her and then entered the pine woods to her left and climbed a small rise which commanded the road. It was very warm. She sat fanning herself and the gnats that shimmered before her eyes. It was an old woman who came along, laden with empty meal sacks and conversing earnestly with herself. Later, two boys passed, laughing and punching each other. The watcher on the hill fanned and sighed. "I wished he'd come on," she said. When he did come, he looked like a man who has a long way to go. He had the supplies in a sack over his shoulder, and he went by slowly with his eyes to the ground. She crouched low while he passed, and when he was gone, she rose and dusted off her dress and took up her bundle and returned to the road again, walking out his tracks to the crossroads and the store. The storekeeper was a dark, lean German of middle years whose wry humor merely puzzled the occupants of the 500 square miles of sparse and bitter land he commissaried. He watched her at the screen door until she got it open and entered, diffident, almost disdainful, as if sore put upon to take her trade to such a place.